As you heard in the notices, when Carol talked about the art exhibition we're having over Easter, we've picked up on this theme of journey. And we've been asking people to create stuff that expresses kind of what journey means for them. And I for one, am actually really quite looking forward to seeing what people have produced. So if you're free Wednesday evening, come along. There'll be more time to look, but you'll be able to have a look at it all the time. We're open kind of for Easter services, and kind of we'll probably try and keep up as long as we can the following week. Today, in some ways, flows out of my journey. Kind of part of the reason we've talked a bit more about creativity in church is the vicar's been trying to make sense of kind of how God has made him. And one of the things I've been aware of increasingly is that I see the world kind of and make sense of the world visually, kind of more than orally or kind of in word. And it's also, I guess, how I've discovered I need to express myself. And Carol last week was talking about identity. So kind of that's part, I realise, is more and more part of my identity. Kind of, and I guess what we want to be trying to do is create a situation where we can all be kind of making sense of how God has made us, and kind of using the things God's put in our lives to express our faith and to make sense of the world in which we come to. So in a way, kind of part of what I'm talking about today reflects the journey that I'm on, but it also focuses on the journey that Jesus was on. Kind of today's Palm Sunday. We aren't always very good at being very Anglican. Kind of we do manage to get Easter on the right day, and kind of we do generally manage to get Palm Sunday in, and don't panic, there are palm crosses at the back before you go. We haven't forgotten that. But kind of on the whole, we don't necessarily stick to the Anglican calendar that much. But there's another name for Palm Sunday, and it has a different aspect. It's Passion Sunday. And that reflects kind of the fact there's a choice to kind of focus on the triumphal entry or to focus on the cross. And the problem with the cross is often kind of it gets missed out as we approach Easter. Yes, if we gather on Good Friday, we talk about it. But next Sunday, we're going to be talking about the resurrection almost as if the cross hasn't happened if you aren't with us kind of in between this week. And Passion Sunday brings the cross into view before Easter. So kind of what I want to do today is I'm not really going to speak on Palm Sunday or Passion Sunday. I'm going to talk on the betrayal of Jesus. It's almost like we're going to stand in the middle and we're going to look both ways, back to his entry into Jerusalem, but forward to the kind of the events that follow his arrest, his trial and his death on the cross. And that's kind of where we are today. We're focusing on those events in between the entry and in between the cross, because Jesus's betrayal sheds light on both. But actually, journey is a good way to describe Jesus's life and Jesus's ministry. It's like he always had a destination in mind, it's almost there before he was born. You know, Isaiah says he was pierced for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him. It's almost like before he took our flesh, kind of in God's purposes, the cross was the ultimate end of the journey for Jesus. And Jesus' own words confirm that. The Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And it seems to me that this sense of journey and journey towards the cross is never more apparent than kind of the final sections of Jesus' ministry. Kind of if you know your Gospels, you will know that the bulk of the Gospels takes place in and around Galilee, where Jesus teaches the people, and kind of where he heals the sick, where his actions, as well as his words, speak of who he is. And the culmination of probably what is over 2 years of ministry in and around Galilee is when he takes his disciples to one side at a place called Caesarea Philippi. And it's a bit like he gives them their final exam. He takes them aside to check out whether they've kind of understood what they've seen happening before them. And so he begins with this question, who do the people say I am? And then he leads into another question, a more personal question, directed to the disciples. Who do you say I am? And as is often the case on these occasions, there's a lot of spluttering and a lot of people looking into their laps and not saying anything. And it's Peter with the big mouth that turns round and gives this amazing declaration that you are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God. And kind of it's like, yes, the pen is dropped. They've made sense of what they've seen happening before them. And then suddenly the whole emphasis of kind of Jesus's ministry shifts. It's no longer about Galilee and people discovering who he is. It becomes now about why he's come. And the focus moves to Jerusalem. And the journey to the cross kind of begins in earnest. It's almost like he sets his face to Jerusalem. And it may be a 5-day walk from Galilee to Jerusalem. It seems like it takes him longer because if you read the Gospels, there are lots of different encounters that take place along the way. There's teaching that takes place along the way. But now his ultimate goal is Jerusalem. And he explains it in this way. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders and chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day raise the dead. I can't put the typo in there as well. Sorry about that. Who spotted that? And that follows directly after that kind of taking aside at Caesarea Philippi. It's the major shift in his ministry from Galilee to Jerusalem and to the cross. And so the journey begins in earnest. Kind of the conclusion of that journey is that triumphal entry, if you like, into Jerusalem, the adulation of the crowds, and kind of it appears like it's a very different ending to the one that's described in those verses. But today's focus is the very end of the journey. It begins with the journey into the night. Jesus has spent this last night on earth with his friends. He's served them. He's washed their feet. He's shared the Passover. We were reading this kind of when we meet for prayer on Tuesday mornings, and when it describes him talking to the disciples about wanting to share the Passover with them, it kind of says to them, he says to them, yeah, I really want to share this meal with you. There's this kind of really personal moment here where he's saying, this last meal that I'm going to share with you matters. But what a bitter sweet meal. I mean, I can't eat if I'm nervous and I've got any sort of anxiety. It's about the only thing that does stop me eating. How do you eat when you know what's coming before you that night and the next day? And there's so much that's bittersweet about that meal. He predicts his betrayal, and Judas departs into the night. Peter, too, is confronted with his denial. And then there's this kind of argument between disciples about who's the greatest. It's not exactly how you would want to be prepared to face the most difficult thing you're ever going to face. And eventually Jesus goes out into the night. And in Gethsemane, I mean, you know, ironically, Gethsemane is just below the Mount of Olives where that triumphal entry into Jerusalem began. There are stones throw apart. But rather than the cries of Hosanna and adulation, kind of Jesus prays alone, and agonizes and asks the Father for this cup to be taken from him, but continues to choose to surrender to God's will. And somehow, the disciples, in another moment of glory, manage to sleep through all of that agony. And then comes the passage that Sandra read for us, Jesus' arrest. Can we have the next slide up, thanks? This is Caravaggio's rendering of that arrest, the beginning of that final journey from Jesus from the garden to the cross. I love that prayer that that Sarah used, that kind of picked up on that journey, the high priest's house, all the different places that would bring indignity upon indignity on him in that journey. I had a chance to have a look at this painting. Normally it's on display in Dublin. It was in the National Gallery earlier this year. And if you're part of St. Matt's, you know that the vicar has this kind of really strange desire to kind of take paintings and recreate them photographically. So kind of the moment I saw it, I knew I wanted to have a go. If I'm honest, I was a little bit nervous about asking anyone to take part in it, partly because it is kind of claustrophobic, isn't it? They are in each other's face. It's not kind of a comfortable thing to kind of recreate. And I don't want to give you a history lesson, but I do want to use kind of Caravaggio's painting and my kind of poor attempt at kind of recreating it, just to pick up on some of the stuff that's going on in Jesus' betrayal. I'm just going to a bit about the painting first. Kind of one of the things I love about Caravaggio is that his paintings are contemporary. I mean, we look at it and it looks kind of old, but actually it was contemporary to his day. The guards aren't dressed in Roman armour. They're in kind of the armour of Lombardy of the 16th century. He uses this kind of classic lighting that kind of picks out the key people. And normally where the light comes from is really clear. Often it's a window or the moon or a candle or a lantern. And there is a lantern in this one, but it's not the light source. And kind of where the light source is, isn't quite so clear. But it's kind of typical, kind of dramatic lighting that I love, which is why I like Caravaggio's work as well. And then there's this wonderful sense of colour in it. I mean, it doesn't come out so well on there, but it's this kind of beautiful red cloth that kind of circles through the whole thing. And one of the things I love about Caravaggio is that he's real. Kind of the fellow artists and kind of the art critics of his day criticised him because he didn't make pretty art. The people he painted were often the people that were kind of out of the taverns or the homeless on the streets. The people that had seen a bit of life, and he uses that to make what he paints kind of come to life. But this is a little bit different even for Caravaggio. I don't know about you, when I look at it, it's almost like a painting, it's almost like a photograph rather than a painting. Kind of, it's not nicely spaced out, it's not kind of artistically arranged. It's kind of almost like someone has snapshotted, the paparazzi at work has captured this moment as it takes place. Not stage managed, but before them, bodies intertwining, trying to grab hold of Jesus. It kind of has this kind of, this sense of action and kind of reality. Even one of the disciples' arms is cut off, which kind of can't be great artistic kind of practice. So kind of Caravaggio draws, I think, from all of the Gospels in what he kind of records here. Sandra kind of set the scene for us with that reading from Matthew. While he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived. With him was a large crowd armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priests and the elders. And now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. The one I kiss is the man, arrest him. And going at once to Jesus, Judas said, greetings, Rabbi, and kissed him. And of course, the central kind of characters to this event are in kind of the heart of this picture. Kind of Jesus with his arms threaded together, looking forward, and then Judas grasping him and kind of leaning in for the most unromantic of kisses. Kind of then there are other characters. The one with the arm cut off and reaching and trying to run away. Kind of people that study it say it was probably the Apostle John. I just wonder, you can't see it terribly easily, but if you look into it, there's a pair of hands somewhere in between the soldier and Judas. They're just up there, and it appears like they're grabbing the cloak that the guy running away is wearing. And that just makes me wonder if it's not the Apostle John, if actually it might be Mark, the writer of Mark's Gospel. Because he's the only one that records the young man who's at the arrest, who escapes, but at the cost of his clothes. He runs away naked because they've grabbed his clothes and in his attempt to get away. I don't know. So it makes me wonder if that's him. And then we have these kind of soldiers that are anonymous. And unusual for Caravaggio, well, not unusual, he does it elsewhere, actually. The character right at the back, kind of, who actually is the one holding the lantern, is actually Caravaggio himself. He's included himself in the painting. One of the other ones he does it in, which is quite hilarious, well, perhaps not so, he includes himself in his painting of the beheading of John the Baptist. His head is John the Baptist's. Would you like a bit of really geeky art history? Yeah, go on your word, wouldn't you? Caravaggio is about the most unsavory character you can imagine. He's a brilliant artist, but he's a total drunkard. He has a violent temper. He frequently gets into fights. He frequently is thrown in jail. He's tolerated because of the brilliance of his art. It culminates in him murdering someone and having to flee Rome. And this is painted before that takes place. And he flees to Naples. Eventually, he moves around a number of different places, but he ends up in Naples, where we think he dies. But while at Naples, he kind of wants to get back to Rome, and so he paints an apology. And the apology is the beheading of John the Baptist with his head on the platter. And he sends it to a cardinal who he hopes will receive the gift and out of that invite him back to Rome. But he never gets back to Rome anyway. That's the geeky bit out of the way. Sorry, I just find that kind of gory, but kind of weirdly amusing. I don't know. Anyway, but one of his signatures is this kind of whole lighting thing. And kind of his lighting style is almost described as being like lit by a lantern, that this kind of light shines in. But on this occasion, the lantern isn't the light. The light's on Jesus. It's not coming from the lantern. It might illuminate Caravaggio's face, but it doesn't actually illuminate anything else. Well, okay, let's depart from the art, and we'll just move to kind of my attempt at rehashing this, shall we? Can we have the next slide? You may recognize some of the faces. Most of the people in it have chosen today as being a Sunday not to be here. Mark, you're very brave. Either that, you didn't know it was happening. Harvey has gone as far as to get the flu. Andrew Mackay has gone as far as Lanzarote. I don't know where Graham Hickson Smith is hiding, but clearly he knew it was happening as well. But most of the people that were willing to take part have kind of run away. I'm really grateful for Mark and Graham, Harvey, Julian, Andrew and Brian, who is hidden in the back there somewhere. And also for Gavin Loosley, who stepped in and was kind of in the thing until I stepped in to fit into the Caravaggio bit. Kind of, as you can see, it's all about kind of trying to emulate the lighting and trying to emulate the positions, which I think it might have been a bit torturous for those doing it. I think Graham and Harvey got to know each other a whole lot better over the course of the evening. I really hope they were wearing their deodorant. That's all I would say, really. Kind of, and they'd had mints or something and not garlic before they came. But they were absolute stars, all of them. It seems to me that somehow Caravaggio and what kind of we tried to copy portrays probably almost kind of every human response to what's happening. Cover the next slide. Let's just start with Mark. Literally, Mark or Mark, depending on which way round you want to go. There's the disciple who, on the end, who's almost in blind panic, desperately trying to get away, I guess motivated by self-preservation. And it's interesting, you often hear when Christians talk about the persecuted church that probably we would all say we just kind of wonder how we would respond if we were the ones that are being persecuted for our faith. I wonder how we would respond. You know, these aren't just the people that cried Hosanna when Jesus went into Jerusalem. These are the people that have shared his life for the last 3 years, who at a meal literally hours before had promised they would never run away and never fail him. And suddenly, that's exactly what they're doing. And then there, the soldiers. Can we have the next one? We couldn't manage. Well, we didn't want armor. We wanted to do it in a contemporary way. We were hoping for some proper police or uniforms. We kind of made do with some pretty basic stuff. But there's Julian, there's Andrew. And somewhere in the back corner is actually Brian. Thank you. You can actually just about see him there. And it's almost like they're expressionless. They're grabbing hold of Jesus. They're trying to do their job. And as I said, Canavo was a junkard. He had plenty of runs in with the police. He probably paints from experience. The police of his day would have been used to rounding up drunks. These were probably the temple guards that were kind of under the control of the high priests. But there is something about kind of people being put in this position that actually means there's a real danger of being brutalized, of seeing things that you don't want to see and being asked to do things that you don't want to do. And there's a real potential for the hardening of the human heart, of being dehumanized when that happens. And there's a sense of that in the guards. And then there's Jesus and Judas. Thank you. The central figures. And all of the Gospels record the kiss. Mark's the most economical about it. And that he that betrayed him had given them a token saying, "Whomsoever I shall kiss, that is he. Take him and lead him away." It's only Luke that adds another line. Jesus' response to that kiss. And the words that he records Jesus saying are, "Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" And the tension here between Jesus and Judas couldn't be kind of any greater. There's an intensity about Judas forcing himself to do this thing, and that there's a passivity about Jesus, not resisting or avoiding it, but kind of welcoming it is the right word. A commentator on the painting of Caravaggio's asked the question, is Jesus flinching in it? And perhaps we could just jump on. Is that all right? Can we just jump to the next one? I don't know. I mean, it doesn't look like Jesus is pulling back. He's just standing there, allowing Judas to betray him and to betray him in the most intimate of ways. I mean, I know that a kiss was kind of like our equivalent to a handshake in those days. But there's something so much more personal about greeting someone with a kiss and then to use it as the very act of betrayal. He leans in and it's like, you know, Jesus is passive. Judas grabs him, kisses him. But is it just me? He doesn't look him in the eye, does he? It's like he can't look him in the face as he does it. And along with Judas's hands are the other soldiers grasping him. I'm really grateful for Harvey playing Judas. I don't think any of us kind of really wanted that one. And I don't think many of us would choose that role or choose to identify with Judas. We were talking a little bit about Judas on Tuesday morning when we were kind of reading through these passages. And kind of, there's a sermon in Judas alone, isn't there, really? And it begs some very big questions. Because Jesus clearly knows who is going to betray him. He kind of makes reference to having kept all of his disciples except the one that was kind of doomed from the very beginning, he says at one point. And so it just kind of begs this big question. Does Judas have a choice in what he's doing? He's somehow God's unwitting tool in this that has no choice but to face not just Jesus' destruction, but his own destruction. I think this is all about God's and Jesus's foreknowledge of what will happen. It's all about the brokenness of Judas's humanity. And it seems to me he must have a choice. And I think there's a warning to us in that. No matter what we're struggling with, no matter how big or how unsurmountable it is, we can't just say we can't do it. Actually, we always have a choice. We lie to ourselves if we say we don't. But we can choose not to. And Jesus doesn't. I'm losing track of what slide I'm on now. I think we'll just stick with... Yeah. Is that the next one? It was the next one. And let's just go back to this one. Keep going. One more. I'm drawing to a close, really. Judas betraying Jesus of all the people in the picture, though, is the victim. He's the one that's going to face the consequences of these actions. And it seems like he's totally at peace in the middle of this melee or storm. Contrast his hands with every other set of hands in this picture. Jesus is it's almost like he's chosen to hold them in resignation, to do nothing in any way that would resist what is going to happen. And Judas reaches out and grasps him. The soldier kind of follows Judas's lead, kind of grasping hold of Jesus. Then you have a disciple trying to get away. There's almost kind of the light trying to, symbolizing wanting to see what's going on. I don't know. More of that in a moment. But Jesus is the one, it seems to me, actually out of all of them, he's the one that's really in control. And that's kind of, it seems to me, what characterizes everything that follows. Even though he is presented before every authority in Rome, the Jewish authorities, the chief priests, the Roman authorities, Pilate, even though they supposedly have authority over him, he's the one that chooses the path and kind of sets the agenda. Even when he can step back from the cross, when Pilate offers him a way out, he still chooses this path. He chooses to finish this journey. He still chooses the cross. And we see that choice here in this picture. And okay, we are coming into land. There's that one final person in the picture. I'm really grateful for everyone that helped me because it meant that I could actually get my own face into one of these. I'm not sure I really wanted to. I much prefer photographing other people than being photographed myself. But I kind of felt that if Caravaggio was in it, then probably I ought to be in it too. We had Gavin Loosley sort of standing there most of the way through so we could pose it and get it right before I kind of stepped in for the final picture. And kind of we substituted the lantern with a mobile phone. The light was on, but you can't really see it in the darkness. But actually, that's not a bad thing, because you don't get much light from Caravaggio's lantern either. The light hardly touches the scene. The light here really is all directed at Jesus and this image. As I said, it's not the only time that Caravaggio includes himself in an image. But this image isn't being kind of painted as an apology. It's a commissioned work. And it just leaves me kind of thinking, well, what are you doing in this picture, Caravaggio? Why are you choosing to place yourself in this image? And kind of as I think about that, it seems to me it's almost as if he is drawn to the events he depicts. It's like he's wanting, you know, certainly the figure there, it doesn't come out quite so well with me because I'm a bit too short. I probably should have been standing on a box. But it's almost like in the painting that Caravaggio is kind of standing up and over and peering into the scene that he's created. It's almost like he's wanting to look into those events and try and make sense of them for himself. Kind of a reflection perhaps of his own searching and his own journey. And I just wonder, alongside that, is there a sense of him choosing to associate himself with what's happening in front of him, of saying in some way, this isn't just a scene I paint, but in some way I'm part of it? And actually, isn't there something in that for all of us? You know, it's easy to read the events of Holy Week, be it the triumphal entry or kind of the crowds that cry crucify, that kind of that hurl abuse at Jesus kind of on the cross, and look at these from a distance and think they're other people. But actually, if we have been living in Jerusalem and part of those weeks, what part would we have played? Where would we have stood? What would we have cried? Hosanna or crucify or both? Caravaggio puts himself in the scene and says somehow these actions that took place, well, it was 1600 years before then, wasn't it? 2000 years ago now. These touch all of our lives. They touch my life too. And perhaps that's one of the things that's powerful about Palm Sunday, about taking a palm cross. It's a way of connecting with what happened then and saying it was, and acknowledging it was for us too. Let's pray. Lord, it's easy to stand and look on the outside in. Help us to realise that those events of that first Easter aren't just about events that are a history lesson. They change the world and they can change our lives. Amen.